We're now into IFRS 3, paper 15, reverse acquisition accounting. Denise?
Hi, good morning.
Paper 15 addresses two requests that we received, one from ESMA and the other one from the CASB, to clarify the accounting for transactions that reflect reverse acquisitions where the accounting acquiree is not a business. IFRS 3 business combinations does not provide explicit guidance for reverse acquisitions in which the accounting acquiree is not a business. In the fact patterns that were described in the submission, we observed that there is a non-operating entity that has a public listing, which legally combines with an existing non-listed operating entity so that the latter can obtain a market listing. At least that's what the objective, that's what we think was the objective. To analyze this submission, we asked the following questions. Who is the acquirer in this transaction? Does a non-operating entity constitute a business? How should the transactions be accounted for? So based on the guidance in Appendix B of IFRS 3, we determined that the legal acquiree can be considered the accounting acquirer in this transaction. We also determined that the accounting acquiree does not constitute a business. And this is because, in our view, the only elements that were acquired by the accounting acquired are inputs, and no processes have been applied to those inputs to create outputs. And the inputs that were acquired are cash and or minor net assets, not relevant net assets, and a listing status. And then we determine that the listing status is an acquired service in accordance with the guidance in IFRS 2, share-based payments, that should be expensed. We also concluded that the transactions should be accounted for as share-based payments in accordance with IFRS 2, where the accounting acquirer acquires a service, which is a listing status, from the accounting acquiree, and in exchange, it receives equity instruments. In the final part of our paper, we're asking the committee to advise us on whether we should propose an amendment to IFRS 3 to clarify this issue due to the lack of guidance in IFRS 3 for these transactions, or whether we should issue an interpretation, which we will discuss with you at the future meeting. And just finally, I would like to mention that yesterday we received a comment letter from the CASB to this paper, where they basically say that there is no reasonable basis to support that the transactions, that the transaction analyzed in their submission constitutes a vehicle to obtain a public listing, and instead they say that there is more evidence to support that this transaction is a capital transaction accompanied by a recapitalization. So you have copies of this letter, and this letter has been posted to the public website as well. So, all yours.
Try to finish the day on an easy one. Not. Comments? Reactions? Ross?
No, it's not an easy issue. Up until now, I've always viewed this type of transaction leading to the recognition of an expense, because I was effectively applying the logic of reverse acquisition and taking it as similarly to an entity going for a listing without issuing capital, and so the expenditure should be recognized as an expense rather than against the cost of equity. But when we get to the stage of drafting a Q&A and supporting the reasoning for an expense, then we stumble into the question of why isn't it an intangible asset? How justify it's not an intangible asset? Because you are acquiring a legal right, agree, it's not separable from the business and so on, but it's still, it's a legal right to have your share traded and to meet certain investors and to issue capital and so on. It's legal rights. You've got them, those rights. Why don't you meet and you expect to economic benefits and so on and so on? So how do you overcome the definition and recognition of an intangible asset when you do it externally? Then it calls into my question about, but what if you do it just internally? I mean, without acquiring an entity to get the listing, you just go for a listing. Would this lead you to recognize an intangible asset rather than an expense? And how would you justify the difference? Perhaps here one argument could be built that if the entity goes itself for a listing, it's not just a listing, maybe you're also developing internally generated goodwill. And we have those requirements in IS-38 that says that when you spend expenditure and you don't know exactly how to make the split in your expenditure for internally generated goodwill or acquisition of another intangible asset, and you can't measure the cost reliably, then you recognize as an expense. So I could get there as an expense for if an entity goes for listing itself. But still, I do have that question about when I go for listing in doing that reverse acquisition, how do I overcome the fact that it meets the definition of an intangible asset, recognition of an intangible asset? And the IFRS 2 solution you propose does not solve the issue.
Julie?
Where may I?
Yeah, Luca, you'll follow Julie.
Several thoughts came to mind when I read this paper, but let me raise one right now because it built on something Laurent said. The paper talked about a right, and she mentioned a right, and I said to myself, granted by whom? I mean, to have a right, you've got to, if this shell entity has a right, if that's what it is, a right, it's got to be, there's a counterparty, right? There's somebody on the other side. Who are we assuming has granted this right? And the reason I ask is because using the SEC as a securities regulator, we don't grant rights to offer shares. I mean, we have laws that you need to comply with if you're going to do it, and we check, you know, do some checking about your compliance. We're the cop on the beat, if you will. But we don't grant a right. So I wasn't sure. I wanted to explore that. It's somewhere in the conversation because it seems somewhat integral to the thinking.
Yeah, the use of the term right may be inelegant, to quote a presidential candidate. But I think we have said that in other situations, a place in line. So the fact that you're first in line as opposed to last in line can be an intangible asset. And I think this is more like that. I already have my place in line because I have an established listing. I don't have to incur the additional costs of going through an IPO and that. So I agree with you. It's not a right like a license. But in other situations, I think the board has said, well, we're going to take a broader view of that and say, if you're first in line and people will pay you for the fact that you're first in line, that can be an intangible asset. But I think you're right there. John?
Yeah, we have a number of those transactions in Canada, and basically in our context, it is essentially obtaining a listing, a public listing. That's the only purpose of those transactions. So I agree. I don't see a right. It's not a right. I get a listing. So for me, the question is whether those costs are cost of issuing shares or whether they're cost of getting a listing. And I don't believe they're cost of issuing shares. The purpose is not to issue shares. The purpose is to get a listing. if I issue shares, because I have a certain incremental nominal, certain incremental issuance of shares, is to acquire the cash that is there and to pay the cost of getting the listing. But I don't believe that it is an exercise of issuing shares. It's essentially to get a public listing. And I don't believe that getting a public listing is a cost of issuing shares, and therefore they do not qualify as capital transaction. So I don't see that as an intangible asset. The staff has explained in the paper why they don't view that as an intangible asset. Obtaining a public listing is, for me, it's not an intangible asset that I can distinguish, I can trade, I can value independently. So I think I agree with the staff. I think it's expense, and that's...
Oh, yeah, Luca, please. I'm sorry. Thank you for reminding me.
I have more or less the concern indicated by Julie and others relating it to the qualification of this listing status. I'm not sure that we are speaking about something that can be qualified as a service. And at the same time, I have some doubts that that is an intangible asset, because the listing status probably could be some, there could be some differences in different jurisdictions, but it is a characteristic of shares. I have doubts to say that it is an intangible asset that can be qualified as an asset, so that is something that permits you to have a benefit. Therefore, probably the effect is the same, that is the recognition in the profit or loss, but I think that we have to go more in depth on this classification and qualification of the listing status, like an element of cost rather than a qualification of the shares rather than an intangible asset, because this could have an effect in the accounting treatment. For the rest of the paper, I agree that the relevant part of IFRS 3 are used in order to identify the real acquirer and the real acquiree, and state that there are space enough inside IFRS 2 in order to qualify the transaction inside the IFRS 2 principles. In any case, I think that the main issue is to go more in depth in the analysis of the qualification of this listing status that is the object of the acquisition.
Joanna?
In terms of the nature of the costs, if you like, I absolutely agree that with John that they are in the nature of IPO type costs, and certainly there are a number of reverse transactions or cash pop transactions in my country, and the sole purpose is to get the listing. And so I agree that they should be costs, and I think that, as you argue in the paper, it's very hard to justify that they're intangibles. In terms of where we go with this, I have to admit that, like, you offered up an annual improvement or a interpretation. I actually wonder whether, because it seems from what you're saying that everyone is actually almost on the same page as to what the answer is, i.e. that it is that you should be looking at 3 and 2 and dealing with them like that. And I wonder whether, in fact, we could do it more simply, and I haven't got the words, actually through a agenda decision rejection, by actually saying, well, no, it's not 3 because it's not a business. It's not 2 because it actually isn't that. You've got to go to 8. You don't go to US GAAP. You look at 3 and 2. And, by the way, they're IPO-type costs. So I actually think that, and I mean, I know that some people would say that's an interpretation, but I wonder whether we can structure a rejection statement, because it could be more effective to do it that way, rather than an interpretation.
Scott? Excuse me, Scott, and then John.
That I think most of these transactions have two purposes. They raise capital and they go public. And that's the same thing that happens when a company does an IPO. I mean, there's two purposes. They're raising capital and they're going public. I've seen plenty of IPOs where the company doesn't actually sell any shares. It's only selling shareholders that sell shares. And the reason the company is going public is either because their shareholders told them, we want you to do it so we can get rid of our shares, or the company wanted to go public to create a currency for future acquisitions by having its shares public. And I think when a company goes IPO and incurs a bunch of costs and sells a bunch of shares itself, we don't really try to separate the costs into the IPO costs and the other costs, do we?
Yes. Split them between those that relate to share raising and those that relate to the IPO.
And is there a basis for doing that?
Yes.
Well, if that's the case, then there's no reason to do anything different here. We ought to still split the costs. I happen to see arguments for both capital and expense. I don't see an intangible asset here. I'd support any answer that gets clarity to this, whether we do it in a rejection notice or an annual improvement or in an interpretation. I'm open to doing it in any way we can. Doing it in a rejection notice normally would bother me because I think this will obviously change the accounting that some people feel is right. The Korean Accounting Standards Board obviously feels that it's not an expense. But in this instance, for just about any company, this is a one-time transaction, and I don't particularly mind putting it out in a rejection notice because of that. The next time they do the transaction, the guidance will be there for them, and it's not like this affects anybody's ongoing accounting. So for that reason, I could support doing it in a rejection notice, as Joanna suggests, even though I think there's probably enough diversity in view here that normally I wouldn't want to do it in a rejection notice.
John, and then Julie.
I suppose just to agree with much of what's been said, I don't believe it's an intangible asset. I think if a company was just going to do a normal listing, we wouldn't consider capitalizing the cost as acquiring some form of right, so I don't believe it's an intangible asset. I think it's a listing transaction. It may or may not involve an equity raising, and if it does, the cost would be allocated between the equity raising and the listing costs, and if it's just a listing, then it would be expensed as the cost of acquiring the listing. I do think clarity would be good, and how we do that, I suppose I'm somewhat indifferent to, but I do think that there is a diversity in how people account for this and look at this, so I think clarifying it as along the lines of what the staff have proposed is worthwhile.
Julie?
A convergence point with my U.S. hat on. I think under U.S. GAAP, especially as augmented by what SEC staff has said, practices more charging its capital versus expense. And yet we would be invoking two documents, the BizCom IFRS standard and the stock-based compensation IFRS standard, that are largely converged with U.S. GAAP. So I wondered about that part of it. Because you're drawing on literature that's largely the same on both sides of the pond, yet you would be getting different answers if you went the expense route here than I think generally is what is done in the U.S. So did the staff explore that, or do they have any concerns about that potential divergence? And is it worth exploring working with that same literature? Why in the U.S., we've tended to grow up the other way? Is that enlightening at all to this issue? And even if it's not enlightening and this seems like a better answer, how are we going to handle that piece of it?
Denise?
Yeah, no, I did check the guidance in US GAAP. I couldn't really find the rationale behind that decision. I did check several documents from issued by the SEC. I do not know if you know more about the rationale behind the fact that it should be.
If you wanted to go further, maybe we don't, but if you did, and you didn't have the opportunity to talk to the staff, like, we could arrange that. But I don't have, this is a really old position. I mean, it goes way back, probably before Scott and my careers even began, so we need to draw on people who've even been at the SEC longer than I had to understand the rationale. But if that was relevant, I could try to help get more information. But if you don't need it, then so be it.
I suppose an observation I'd make is that at the moment under IFRS, there's diversity in practice, as opposed to under US GAAP, there is a single way of doing it. We're not in a position similar to some of the other issues related to IFRS 3 we've looked at before, where there is already convergence and we might be creating divergence here. So we're not in that position. And I wonder whether in US GAAP, given the difficulties that we'd had in finding specific literature, whether it reflects practice over time that has developed. And I guess that's what one of the P's in, or what the P in GAAP stands for.
Yeah. I think my understanding is it is practice over time, but as augmented, if you will, by how the SEC staff, has taken positions and situations or made remarks, et cetera, ostensibly with some thought to the situation. So in a peer literature standpoint, we wouldn't create divergence, regardless of how we answered it here. But in terms of what's in the actual financial statements under both sets of literature, I think if we went the expense route here, I think that would make a difference. I'm not suggesting we not do it because we should solve the IFRS issue, the divergence that exists. All I'm suggesting is, have we thought enough about it? How are we going to articulate that piece of it? And do we know enough about why US GAAP practice is different and that's okay or that's fine, and can explain that to people who no doubt would ask?
Okay. Andrew and then Scott. Then Lawrence.
So I was fine with where the paper ended up, but just to come back to Joanna's summary of where we were, I thought we got to expense by looking at IFRS 2. Because I thought you said we're not in 2, but I thought that's how we got to the answer if you look at paragraph 78 of the paper.
Yeah, but we're not actually into per se when we're looking at these transactions. We got there by, I think, by rationalizing to 2.
Well, no, in the paper I said it's an IFRS 2 transaction, but I can understand what you mean, that you instead apply IS 8 and then by analogy you apply bits and pieces from IFRS 3 and IFRS 2.
Well, I don't mind, but I mean, I thought IFRS 2 contains the relevant guidance in all, if there's a difference between the fair value of what you issue and the fair value of what you got, and it's unidentifiable.
In the paper, that's what I'm saying, that is, the transaction is analyzed, is in substance, a share-based payment analyzed under IFRS 2, but then IFRS 2 doesn't give you all the guidance, so that's why you have to go to 3.
I'm fine with the answering.
Laurent?
I was not seeing where there is a share-based payment, really, in these types of transactions. More simply, so far, I've always analyzed the substance of the transaction, which is to get to a listing, and reading the paragraph 37 and 38 of IS 32. Which says transaction costs at rate... transaction costs that relate jointly to more than one transaction, for example, cost of concurrent offering of some shares and the stock exchange listing of other shares are allocated to this transaction using a basis of allocation that is rational and consistent with similar transactions. That's paragraph 38 and 37 that says transaction costs are, of an equity transactions are accounted for as a deduction from equity to the extent there are incremental costs directly attributable to the equity transaction that otherwise would have been avoided. the cost of an equity transaction that is abandoned and recognized as an expense. But it's that are otherwise would have been avoided. So for me, I always accounted for such expenditure against equity if I get cash, but when it's just for listing, it just goes for an expense.
Scott?
Just to clarify a few things and follow up on Laurence, I mean, Laurence's comment, in most of these merger SPAC transactions, they do get cash because there's cash in the entity. So if the answer is if you get cash, it goes against equity, then people will say, oh, then this goes against equity because almost invariably there's cash sitting in the public company that that is involved in these transactions. With respect to practice that is developed under U.S. GAAP, I think that it is just practice that's developed. The SEC helped it develop by just telling people this is what we'll accept. But one of the other differences is that in the U.S. we generally do not separate IPO costs. If a company goes IPO, all the costs are taken against equity. We generally do not book any part of it as an expense. And it's interesting, I look at paragraph 38, it says transaction costs relate jointly to more than one transaction, IAS 32, paragraph 38. For example, costs of a concurrent offering of some shares and a stock exchange listing of other shares. I had always interpreted that as consistent with U.S. practice because you are only listing the shares you sell. I mean, that's officially what the listing is for. Your whole class gets listed, but the reason why you're doing it is so that you can sell the shares. So I hadn't interpreted that as a requirement to separate costs of the IPO, and that's certainly not what we do in the U.S. But if that is what is done under IFRS, I was unaware of it, and that's fine. But that would be another difference that practice has developed over time, and that's a difference that has nothing to do with IFRS 2 and IFRS 3. So it certainly wouldn't bother me because of that to get a different answer under IFRS than U.S. GAAP. I wouldn't be at all troubled by a different answer because there are other pieces of literature that come into play. So that doesn't trouble me at all if we wind up with the difference there.
You know, I'm looking at the Korean letter, and it's unfortunate that our timing schedule is such that it's not their fault it was late. They wanted to get us something, and we got it late. Thinking about their letter and thinking about these, there are a couple of inherent assumptions in this. One is, not an assumption, but a definition, it's an entity that is not a business. One of the entities involved in this does not meet the definition of a business. If it met the definition of a business, we'd be in three, there'd be no question. And I look at their examples, and they have company A, B, and C. And in company A and B, the excess consideration is relatively small, which would be what I would expect if I was just making a decision between doing my own IPO and buying somebody else's place in line. Situation C, that's not true. There's a very material premium. Would lead me to ask, why would you pay that big a premium if the thing you were buying did not meet the definition of a business?
Right.
I suppose if they had a basement full of gold, valued at cost, well, okay, maybe. But that one seems to question the underlying premise, that the transaction, one of the parties to the transaction is not a business. So it might be useful, among other things, to go back to the KASB and say, guys, are you really convinced that all three of these are qualitatively the same kind of a transaction?
Sure.
Now, I heard some people say a rejection notice. I heard other people say it's too big for a rejection notice. I didn't get a general sense.
of how we ought to deal with this. I got a general sense that most people, at least in the population I described, where the premium, where one of the parties is not a business, and so the premium can only be attributed to the buying the place in line, that the answer was debit expense. The question arises, I guess, if you had a situation in which that was not true, which is Company C in the Korean example. Well, but their explanation on the next page leads me to believe it's a business, because they talk about profitable operations.
Company C is a profitable company in substance.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make much sense,
yeah.
Because kind of going in presumption here is that there is no substance.
Yeah. So that's exactly what tripped me, was first the amount of the premium and then second their description. Okay. Do I hear a general consensus for a rejection notice to be developed? And we need to work around the fact that we think in most cases the debit is to expense.
Well, when you say in most cases, you mean any time it's not a business.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I think any time it's not a business, the only reason there can be a debit is because it's an IPO cost. Yeah. Okay, that's what we need to develop, Denise.
Yes.
We'll bring that agenda decision back in November.
We will. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, that, I believe, completes our agenda. Does anyone else have anything to bring before the House?
Wasn't there a rejection notice that was supposed to come back?
Yeah. Well, I hesitate to go there, but what happened about the... B55, the IFRS 3.
Oh, yes.
Leo.
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me. We did ask Leo to bring us one back. I didn't make it clear whether back meant... No, I didn't make it clear. Back meant today. So he needs to get that in front of us.
Wayne, sorry.
Yes, Luca, please.
I have to leave, but I understood that we have completed our activities.
Pardon me, I didn't get I understood I have to leave, but I didn't get the rest of it.
Okay. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Why don't I declare an unofficial 10-minute break?